welcome to episode number 3 of Popular Volcanics, a podcast about volcanoes. I'm Eric Clemente from Denison University and Discover Magazine.
And I am Janine Krippner here at the Smithsonian Global Volcanism Program in DC.
This month's episode is dedicated to answering a lot of questions that many of our listeners had posed to us over the last few weeks. We'll try to get to many of them, and they are a fascinating and varied pile of questions. But we are going to first start off talking a little bit about pumice rafts. And one thing I was curious about, Janine, is that you, being from New Zealand, in some sense, I picture it as the land of pumice rafts, because at least there are pumice rafts that happen to the north of you. Do you have any recollections of pumice rafts when you were growing up in New Zealand? Did people talk about them at all? Or
Not when I was growing up. I mean, you go to beaches in New Zealand, pumice is kind of a normal thing you find, but whether that's from north of New Zealand or from some of the large caldera-forming eruptions we've had in New Zealand, I'm not sure exactly, probably both. But in Australia, I remember a few years back, there was a story about a pumice raft washing up. And the really neat thing about that, not only because it was an eruption from, I think it was about a year previous up around Tonga, but it had formed all of these critters had grown on the pumice. So it was this neat biological raft that was carrying all of these critters and algae and things like that all the way over to Australia. So I remember that one, but I don't know if we just know more about them now that we have so much satellite data, but I imagine these have been happening forever.
Yeah, I mean, so that study there that you're talking about from the eruption, I think it's Home Reef was the eruption that produced the pumice, a 2006 eruption. And there's some great pictures in a study that was on PLOS One, and we'll link it from the page for this episode. But it has some great pictures of like a, you know, adorable tiny sea creatures attached to pumice, like barnacles and anemones and corals and things like that, that then get dispersed around the ocean using these pumice rafts as a mode of transport to lock onto that then carries them with the current wherever they end up. And that's one of the ideas here is how you get some of the redistribution of organisms around. And even, you know, there's even some arm waving about larger things, vertebrates even making their way across on pumice rafts, that it's hard to tell how sort of like apocryphal those stories are.
That is not something I'd like to do.
Yeah, no, probably wouldn't be pleasant. And there's some even, you know, there's the Grimm stories that if one of the famous ones is from the Krakatoa eruption. A year after the eruption, pumice washed up in Africa that had like skeletons on it, which I find that slightly hard to believe, but it's also a weird enough story that it could be true. And, you know, people still today find pumice like on the beaches in Kenya that come from the 1883 eruption of Krakatoa, which that's, again, kind of crazy.
Wow. Well, if anyone out there listening has more information about the skeletons rafting up, please get in touch. I'd love to know more about that.
I think you're right, though, that our knowledge of pumice rafts, because we can watch things happening in the middle of the Pacific, gives us more information about how frequent these things are. And a lot of the times they're actually discovered first by people on the ocean surface in a boat. I know, like in 2012, when there's the Havre seamount that had a submarine eruption north, I think that was in the Kermadec. Mm-hmm. It was first spotted by a research vessel. And then many of us who were into remote sensing at the time, I guess there's lots of people who are doing that, we all traced it back to a source and then, you know, looked at the bathymetry to find what was underneath the source of the pumice raft in the ocean and found Havre as the most likely source. And I think it's been proven now geochemically where they matched pumice from that raft with material from the seamount. A lot of the times that just wouldn't be possible before all of our lovely satellites.
Yeah, that was also the largest, at the time at least, known deep ocean eruption, and it was rhyolite, which is interesting. And it's just fascinating how much we don't know about volcanism under the ocean. For a long time, it was believed that we couldn't have pumice forming deep under the ocean, and that was kind of proved wrong with that eruption. So there's so much more to learn. So I look forward to seeing what comes up with this new one.
All this discussion of pumice rafts actually just comes from the fact that we currently have a pumice raft out in the Pacific that came from a submarine volcano in Tonga that was traced back to somewhere in mid-August. This pumice raft was created. And again, it was discovered by some people in a boat who happened to be traveling from, I think, Tonga to Fiji or somewhere in that vicinity and came across this pumice raft. And then folks were able to trace it back to a submarine volcano that is unnamed, apparently, that has had pumice rafts in the past. But this is, again, a fairly sizable amount of pumice that got brought up to the surface.
Yeah, it really is. That actually leads into one of the questions we got is there a standard process by which volcanoes are officially named? The answer to that is it really depends on the country that's naming them. A lot of volcanoes have names going back to the tribes in the area. But volcanoes, I don't know about in the middle of the ocean necessarily, but when they're in areas that have governments like the Tongan government, those people will be in charge of figuring out how to name that. We can't just name volcanoes.
Yeah, there's been a number of times where islands have been produced from these submarine volcanoes. And that's, of course, the country in question gets the chance to name them. But I think a lot of the times, there's a lot of debate right now, of course, about what names lots of volcanoes should have, because they were renamed as they were areas were colonized by Europeans, and whether we need to start going back to more traditional names. But a lot of the times, there is no convention, international convention, for how naming of features happens. And I have Denison, I think, one of its distinctions, it is the only liberal arts college, to my knowledge, to have a volcano that is named after the college. In the GVP database, there's a Mount Denison in Alaska. It likely hasn't erupted in, it might be like a Pleistocene volcano. So it hasn't erupted in quite a while. There's not a lot of work that has been done on it because it's hard to get to, but it exists. And it was named after the college, but it is one of the few, if only, small liberal arts colleges that has a volcano named after it.
Huh. Well, congratulations.
But yeah, the naming conventions are definitely nothing standard. And, submarine volcanoes, I get the impression it's even more complicated. Sometimes it's the people who are doing the bathymetry, the mapping of the seafloor that name some of these features. And sometimes it's the countries involved, but it's all very non-standard on the whole.
Yeah, I've really appreciated how New Zealand has gone back to the Maori names for volcanoes. So we have Taranaki, which for a while there was called Egmont, but we've really gone back to the traditional Maori names, which I really appreciate. I think we have a beautiful culture and honoring that is really important.
Yep. No, that's a point that people have been bringing up more and more, with like some of the Cascade volcanoes that are just named after various European dignitaries and explorers, and whether we can go back to some of the more traditional names. Things like what we've seen in the US, at least, is things like Denali, which is not a volcano, going back to Denali from McKinley as what it was called for quite a while.
Yeah, we have a lot of work to do when it comes to being respectful to the people that were there before Europeans were.
And a lot of the times, the people who were there before the Europeans actually experienced eruptions from some of these volcanoes. So yeah, I always like to think about the fact that there's reed sandals that were buried underneath ash from the Mazama eruption in Oregon. So people were definitely there before the eruption and were there probably during the eruption. Those are some places that who has the right to name some of those features seems like it shouldn't probably be just whichever cartographer, European cartographer, decided to give it a name.
Agreed.
Well, let's see what else has been going on. We had a lovely op-ed that showed up in the New York Times last week about Yellowstone. Do you have any thoughts on this piece?
Can you hear me rolling my eyes just now? I'm not sure if that came through on the audio. Yeah, I think the piece had some really great points talking about funding for volcano monitoring, but it was really overshadowed by the same thing we have again about when Yellowstone erupts, it's going to destroy life on Earth and it's going to be this huge, enormous eruption. And as we spoke about with Mike Poland in our first podcast episode, that is not something we need to be going over and over and over again. And this comes up every few weeks someone is saying something new about Yellowstone and how terrifying it is. But we know that because of all the amazing work done by the Yellowstone Volcano Observatory, the most likely thing to happen at Yellowstone is a lava flow or a hydrothermal eruption. Generally speaking, the larger the eruption, the more rare it is. And we don't even know if there's eruptible magma beneath that thing right now. So it's, I'm really starting to get very tired of this fear-mongering around this caldera. What about you?
Yeah, it does. It does feel like you have to constant repetition. We learn this. I learned this as a faculty, is that sometimes repetition is the best way to get knowledge across. And we just seem to need to keep repeating that Yellowstone is not the biggest threat to American or any lives in terms of volcanism.
No, it's not the boogeyman, as Mike said.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at National Volcanic Threat Assessment, and the U.S. Geological Survey puts this out maybe a decade or so, where they will look at the volcanoes across U.S. states and U.S. territories and use a whole bunch of different factors to come up with what they call the threat score. And they have a score that encapsulates things related to people on the ground or possibly things related to aviation. And then they rank volcanoes in the country and they divide them up into very high threat, moderate threat, low threat, and very low threat. And there's a grand total of 18 volcanoes in the U.S. that would be considered very high threat. And none of those are Yellowstone. Yellowstone, in fact, doesn't rank in until number 21 on the list. So it falls out of the top 20. But in terms of the threat score, it is less than half of the threat score of the number one volcano, which is what?
I haven't looked at that for a while. Is that Rainier?
Rainier is number three. So you're close.
Oh.
Bear in mind that the extent of activity.
Kilauea,
yeah. So Kilauea sits atop. and then of the Cascade volcano, St. Helens is number one, and it is ranked number two overall. But Rainier, Redoubt in Alaska, and then Shasta in California are the top five because they're relatively near population centers. They're active fairly frequently as volcanoes go. So they pose a higher threat than something like Yellowstone that doesn't erupt as frequently.
Yeah, it's interesting. I'm getting asked, you know, what is the scariest volcano in the United States? It's, you know, I think back to Pinatubo in 1991. You know, that was the second largest eruption of the 20th century, and it wasn't even really recognized as a volcano. It wasn't recognized as a threat before that erupted. So asking us what is going to be the next volcano to erupt, I actually get this question very frequently. Or which is the one that's the scariest in the United States. And we just, it's hard to tell. And that's why people like USGS put so much energy and resources into studying the threat levels. And the threat is a mix of what it could actually do to infrastructure and people and aviation, mixed with the type of eruption styles that it would likely produce. And each volcano produces a wide range of eruption styles. So it's knowing the histories of every volcano and what they've done in the past and what it's more likely to do, and then monitoring them. So to say which one is going to erupt next, you know, with Mount St. Helens before that erupted in 1980, they did know that it was more likely to erupt because it had been so active. But you can't pinpoint which one's going to be next and how big it's going to be and what the impact is going to be. So it's really important to monitor all of the volcanoes and work with communities, which USGS does and local emergency management does, working with communities to be prepared for the different eruption styles. That's more important than asking which is the scariest, which is the boogeyman under the bed we should be worried about.
Yeah, so thinking about, you know, Yellowstone gets the attention because some of its past eruptions have been remarkably huge, and that adds some level of threat, is that there is it can produce very large eruptions. They're very infrequent, but there's lots of other volcanoes that don't produce such extravagantly large eruptions, but are more frequent and closer to population that are larger threats to the country. There's a lot of volcanoes that as we study them more and figure out how often they've erupted, we can get a better sense of what threat they pose. You know, one of the things with the update that they did in 2018 is that a series of rhyolite domes down in Southern California, the Salton Buttes, got elevated into the high threat category because we discovered as a geologic community, that it has had more eruptions and more recent eruptions than was previously thought. So the classifications are flexible, because the more we find out about volcanoes, let's say a volcano in the next decade that is on a lower threat level has a number of eruptions, that might move it up and down the list. So it's just trying to learn what history is recorded at these volcanoes, and changing populations might even affect what we consider a volcano that's a higher threat or a lower threat.
Yeah, I love going to conferences in volcanology and seeing the huge range of science that is thrown at volcanoes to understand how they work. So everything from looking at the crystals that they erupt within the rocks themselves, how far the eruption deposits go, what gases are produced, the seismicity or the earthquakes that are produced during eruptions, all of these different areas that are highly specialized in volcanology go to understanding specific volcanoes, eruption styles, and volcanic unrest, so that we can ask these big questions. The fact that we can even rank the volcanoes in this country means that so much work has gone in over decades in understanding all of these volcanoes. So it's, you know, USGS is doing an incredible job, and they're not alone. They're working with geologists around the country who are looking, well, not just geologists, volcanologists who are studying the deposits of these volcanoes, working to understand them better so that we can know what risks we have.
I'm amused to look at the list here and find that Mount Denison, in fact, ranks number 87 for volcanic threat in the country, which is higher than I expected. That puts it in the moderate, I believe. Let's see the category. Moderate. And it's higher than some volcanoes that I would have assumed were higher, like Mammoth Mountain in California, that's right near the Long Valley Caldera, or Mauna Kea in Hawaii, places like that are, at least in my mind, they seem like volcanoes that might be more likely to have an eruption and are potentially a bigger threat than remote old Mount Denison. Mount Denison ranks just below Haleakala in terms of volcanic threat for the United States.
Wow. And what is it, 161 active volcanic centers on that list?
Yes, 161.
That's a lot of volcanoes.
Yep, especially, you know, this, like I said, this includes territories as well. So it includes volcanoes in the Marianas Islands and American Samoa. It has a wide range. Alaska dominates the list, not surprisingly. There's lots of volcanoes in the Aleutians, but then there's all the Western U.S. volcanoes as well that make up a lot of the list. So, you know, in terms of like states on the list of hazardous volcanoes, most of the high threat ones are places you might expect, like Washington and Oregon and California. You have to get down, let's see, the first state that's kind of a surprise state might be, you get down to number 68, which is the Valles Caldera in New Mexico. And I think a lot of people don't realize that there's a big potentially active caldera in northern New Mexico. Not to say that you should be worried, but there are lots of places to be more worried about, or places that you could be worried about than just Yellowstone.
And they are being watched. Speaking of a lot of volcanic activity, do you know how many ongoing eruptions there are right now?
Many? Sorry, I have no idea. So that's the best I could do.
50. 50 ongoing eruptions around the world. That's saying that there's been some sort of eruptive activity at each volcano within the last 3 months. So 3 months is when we cut it off and say that eruption is over. So, you know, we live on a very active planet. We live on a planet that has earthquakes, big earthquakes, more frequently than I realized as well. We have a planet that produces a heck of a lot of volcanic activity, as well as hurricanes and tornadoes and floods and landslides. Like, this is the planet we live on. So being prepared for volcanic activity in all of these countries that have volcanoes, and there's a lot of them, is something we should just be doing. It's something that we should all be concerned about. You know, even if you live over here in Washington, D.C., we do not have any active or even potentially active volcanoes over here. But we all remember what happens when an ash plume goes from Iceland to Europe. We can all be impacted by volcanic eruptions on the other side of the country. So we should all be caring about this and all be supporting the people that monitor these volcanoes and study them.
We will see, hopefully, in the near future in the U.S., NVIEWS, the National Volcanic Early Warning System, will be ramping up now that it has passed Congress and was signed into law. So we will hopefully be seeing increased installation of instrumentation and a system to help convey that communication from scientists down to the public, or I guess it doesn't have to be down, laterally to the public, communicated to the public in some direction. And that's a good thing. So we should hopefully, at least in the US, start seeing some more instruments on some of these Cascade volcanoes that are lacking such things.
That's pretty exciting. You know, as a volcanologist, I'm driven by two main things. My passion for volcanoes, so I absolutely love these things, and my drive to help people. You know, that's behind all of this communication stuff I do. That's why I'm sitting here recording a podcast right now. And so hearing of these things being taken seriously and support financially and encouragement being given to people who are trying really hard to help communities by having in place systems that people are going to need the next time we have an eruption. Seeing that happening is so good. It's so good to see.
And we've had some, relatively close calls for people over the last week. I know one of the volcanoes on this week's report list is Stromboli. I think there is a video that was floating around, about a boat that was fairly close to an explosion. I think you watched it more closely and maybe know a little bit more than I do about what exactly was happening.
Yes, my goodness, the Stromboli eruption. There was a video taken from a boat. It's a beautiful place out there. There is a lot of tourism and people that live in the area as well. And it gives me goosebumps. There was a pyroclastic flow that raced down the area that had straightened under the ocean. And something that I think people need to be much more aware of is that pyroclastic flows, which are incredibly deeply hot, racing clouds of volcanic gas, volcanic rock, and volcanic ash, which is fragmented rock and glass and crystals. This huge, dangerous, deadly mass races down the volcano at high speeds, and then it goes over the ocean. This is what pyroclastic flows do. They don't stop at the edge of the land. They continue over water. They contain a lot of really hot gases that are less dense than the water, so they just travel straight out over it and towards the boat in that video.
Yeah, I mean, this is definitely that there have been stories and some documentation of pyroclastic flows traveling tens of kilometers out over the ocean after they hit that interface between the landscape and the sea. So they can travel quite a long distance and retain, you know, most of their heat and most of their speed as they go out over that sea. They don't just disappear right at the edge of the island or the coastline, and they don't, you know, plunge underneath the water. They just ride out over the sea. And if you're in a boat, that's probably not the best place to be.
No. There are some pretty scary accounts from the Pele eruption. What was that, 1902?
Yes.
That killed 29,000. There were people on ships out in the water, and the accounts of people getting hit by this incredibly hot wave, it's pretty frightening. It's scary stuff. So to see people, I'm so glad they made it out okay.
Yeah, I mean, and this is now the second time in the last few months that Stromboli has produced some, probably more than the second time it's produced something more explosive than it has over the last few years, but it's definitely the second time people have been far too close for comfort with one of these blasts.
Yeah, and it's the thing with volcanoes like Stromboli is, how long has this volcano been erupting?
I mean, it's been erupting. It has the nickname of what? The Lighthouse of the Mediterranean?
The Lighthouse of the Mediterranean. A really, really long time that this volcano has been erupting. And this leads us really nicely into a question that I saw that was asking about at what stage of eruptions do eruptions cause fatalities? And this is a great example to show that Stromboli is a volcano. There are many of these volcanoes that produce constant eruptions all the time. And then we have what are called paroxysmal events. And that is an eruption at a volcano that's been erupting for a while, producing something much, much bigger than it usually does. And these are often without warning. They can be very dangerous and deadly. Fuego volcano at Guatemala last year is a very good example of that. You know, these are years or decades after the start of these eruptions. Sometimes volcanoes erupt without warning at all, with phreatic or steam eruptions, and those can cause a lot of fatalities. So there's no specific stage of a volcanic eruption near the beginning, middle, or end that I know of that is more likely to produce fatalities. In fact, when we have a volcanic eruption that has been going on for a very long time, people get used to that risk. So there's inherent dangers with each stage of an eruption.
I mean, that's sort of the familiarity breeds contempt phenomenon where people get a little overconfident. A lot of the deaths that have happened with volcanologists, things at, let's say, Galeris in Colombia or Unzen with the crafts, deaths of people who should know better could partially be attributed to the fact that people get too comfortable with assuming they know what's going to be happening at the volcano. This is why you always want to keep that risk, not even in the back of your head, in the front of your head when you're visiting an active volcano, because it is something that, you know, the unexpected can happen. So don't think that if it's been doing X for the last 2 years, it will continue to do X forever, because that's when people really run into problems.
Yeah, I get asked a lot what volcanoes, active volcanoes, I think people should visit. And I honestly, I'll never answer that question. People go to a volcano to see activity and get hurt or killed. I would never forgive myself knowing that I contributed to someone getting hurt. That would be an absolute nightmare. So always be prepared. I even wrote a blog post recently on going to an active volcano, you know, the things I consider before I go. And it's never going to be a complete list, and it's never going to be guaranteeing that you don't get hurt. These things are inherently dangerous as well as amazing and things that we should experience. But there's both sides to that.
So what else are we seeing active around the planet these days?
We have a whole lot. So the Global Volcanism Program has two really fascinating lists. We have the list of active volcanoes, current eruptions that has 50 volcanoes with ongoing eruption activity right now. And then we have the activity for the week, the weekly volcano activity report that's done by Sally Kunzenit. And that is basically a highlight of changes in activity or ongoing activity. It's not the full list, but it's notable activity that Sally has gone out and collected all this huge amount of information and done these quick updates on activity. So in Japan, we have Sakurajima volcano, which I named my cat after, Asosen, Suwanosojima, all of those producing small ash plumes in Japan. In Indonesia, we have activity at Merapi that has a still growing lava dome, produced a block and ash flow, a small one this week. Sangayang Api, Krakatau, Krangatang, Ibu, Dukono, and Tongkuban Parahu, all of those producing ash flows. Karangatang has a lava flow. We in Kamchatka, we have ash plumes at Ipeko, Karimsky, and Shear Village. And I want to get back to Shear Village in a second. We have ash plumes at Ubinas in Peru. In the United States, there is evidence for explosions at Semisopochnoi. There some explosive activity at Shishaldin, and with a growing spatter cone in the summit. So those are some of the updates.
You said you wanted to talk about Shivalich, and
I do.
I want to come back to Shishaldin. So why don't we start with Shivalich?
So Shivalich is a volcano that I actually did my PhD on Shivalich. So I adore this volcano. It's been producing, it's been growing a lava dome that has been producing frequent avalanches and larger block and ash flows, which is particularly a type of pyroclastic flow formed by parts of lava domes collapsing, as well as ash plumes. This is all very normal for this volcano. It's the northernmost active volcano in Kamchatka. Now, last week, there was, I think it was around Sunday, I'm not sure when this happened, but there was an error made in a report saying that there was an ash plume up to 21 kilometers. I ignored it because checking in with KVIRT, the Russian volcano observatory agency, they said it was much smaller. So I didn't think anything of it. But this grew to the point where there were a few websites writing about it. There were dozens of tweets on Twitter. There were YouTube videos made about this. And it ended up taking up at least an hour of my time a few days ago, as well as three other scientists actually, trying to talk about why this hadn't happened. And this goes to, you know, something I say frequently: be very careful about what you read about volcanoes. If you see something written, verify it with the official agency. In this case, Kamchatka is KVIRT. They very clearly mentioned the eruption. It was a much, much smaller ash plume than was going around the internet. But this went crazy. There were even people claiming they had videos of this eruption that hadn't really happened. It did, but much, much smaller than it had. So please be careful what you read. please, especially on social media.
I've seen this sort of thing happen where it has literally been like a decimal point issue, where a 1.7 kilometer plume becomes a 17 kilometer plume. And that's a very different kind of eruption between the two. I don't know what happened there at Shevelich, but that's I have seen snowballs like that start rolling, and it's maddening.
It really is. Yeah, I just started getting bombarded with messages about it, with people asking what was going on. And I'm sitting here thinking, what have I missed? Nothing's going on. And it wasn't. So, you know, always look up the official sources. They are there to inform people. They are there to give information. They're there to monitor the volcanoes and keep people safe and informed. That's what they do. We're all in this to help people and to help people get the right information. That's why we're here.
And on that front, it kind of, again, shingles nicely into what I wanted to talk about with Shishaldin, is that in our last episode, we talked about lava lakes, and we talked about a lava lake on Shishaldin. And apparently, the further research and further imaging from NASA and from overflights that the USGS was doing suggests that there probably wasn't actually a lava lake on Shishaldin. And in fact, it was just a spatter cone. So a place where you had a lot of sort of sticky lava. I hate to use the word spattering out again, but it's like, you know, spinning out of the volcano, and that there probably wasn't a actual lava lake at the summit of Shishaldin. So there's been some reinterpretation of what was happening at the start of some of this newer activity at that Alaskan volcano. That does also lead us into one of the questions that we have been posed from our listeners, and that is, why do lava lakes form to begin with? And I think a lot of it just boils down to you have a lot of magma coming into a volcano, and it's filling up the conduit and persistently stays at that level.
You know, I saw this question, and it really caught my interest. So I actually started looking into it and reading papers and looking at the literature. And I think the honest answer is we don't know. The fact that we have the top of a conduit of a magma system, lava at the surface, God, that lava magma boundary is really bugging me. We have lava at the top of the magma system just sitting there, and this can be persistent for decades. And the fact that that happens blows my mind. You have this dynamic system where you have some overturning of the lava lakes in places, where you have magma rising and then going back down again. You have, you know, this being over 1,000 degrees hot, you're going to have a lot of cooling happening at the surface, especially on these snow-capped volcanoes. You might have crystals forming. You'll have a lot of gas coming out of it. It's all of that happening, and it managing to stay stable for so long just blows my mind.
You know, there's a combination of a lot of different factors, right? We have to have magma that is pretty low viscosity, so it stays like relatively, you know, runny material. It probably doesn't have to, you probably don't want to have a lot of gas in it. Otherwise, it would start erupting maybe a little more vigorously. You want to have enough magma coming in to keep the system hot so you don't end up crusting over the whole lava lake. And you got to keep a lot of that stuff, you know, lava lakes at Kilauea. One of the things that people would watch is how much the lake level would go up and down. And it, you know, you could kind of compare it to, you know, maybe water in a well, that the rate of lava magma coming in underneath the volcano will raise and lower that surface of the lava lake. But it's really complicated. And yeah, you get lava lakes in places that you think it'd be hard to keep that persistent lake surface, like, you know, Erebus in Antarctica is a place that has a persistent lava lake, and it's pretty chilly. But I guess for something that's at 1,000 or more degrees, the difference between something that's sitting at, I don't know, 15 degrees C and minus 10 degrees C isn't that much of a difference. So maybe the cold climate isn't that much of a factor.
No, I thought of that as I was saying it. Like, that's not a great thing to say, but yeah, no, these lava lakes are incredible, and they're all different. And, you know, why did they form? Why did they suddenly drain, like we saw at Kilauea and in Vanuatu last year? Why does some of them drain overflow and then form lava flows? There's a lot of questions out there about these things.
I know that in some of the discussion I've had with folks about the eruptions at Kilauea, you know, a lot of it, they kind of compare it to like your plumbing, where at Kilauea, you see the lava lake levels drop when you have eruptions down on one of the rifts, because you've kind of cracked a pipe downstream, and the lava can evacuate down there. So you've sort of released some of that, you know, what would you call it, magma static pressure that keeps the lava lake level up. I think you're right. You know, you, it sounds like you did a little more poking around than I did. And it sounds like the answer is we don't know the answer.
Yeah, there are some really good ideas about how they work. And we have a lot of good data about what they do. But why they're there and why they manage to stay there, I think that's largely still a mystery. There's a question here that caught my attention, and I think you can answer it quite well with some of your recent fieldwork. What do you look for when examining rocks if they're a part of an ultraplinian eruption? Might want to explain what ultraplinian is first.
So ultraplinian, and I threshold, if I remember this correctly, is something that has a plume that reaches over, is it 50 kilometers, I believe?
That's what I have in my mind.
Yeah.
And I can double check that.
Ultraplinian, as the name implies, is even bigger than Plinian. And when you have that, there's nothing in particular about the rock, the material, the lava, that sets a ultraplinian away from, let's say, a plinian. It's not like the composition will be something distinctly different. It's more going to be the distribution of the material, where what I've always thought is that for a standard plinian eruption, you want to picture like you got a stuff coming out of the top of a volcano and it starts falling out of the sky.
Hang on, let's back up a little bit.
All right.
A plinian eruption is a large explosive eruption. So the stuff that's coming out is a lot of volcanic ash and rock that's being blown apart by the explosive gas that is coming out with it. Carry on.
Yes, no, good. That's I kind of got on a roll there and and got too excited about plinian eruptions. So yes, we have this big explosive eruption going on, and material falls out of that. You know, stuff is being shot upwards, but gravity has it fall back down. And for most eruptions, if you look at the distribution of that material, it's thickest, not surprisingly, near the volcano that's erupting, and it gets thinner as you go outwards. And there'll be some change in the shape of that deposit based on things like wind patterns, maybe something about the directionality of the eruption. Most of the time, they're erupting straight out, but not always. But mostly, it's like wind patterns and things like that. Both lower atmosphere and upper atmosphere winds. But for an ultraplinian eruption, what I recall is that the plume is so tall that it actually means that the thickest deposits are not centered at the volcano. They're centered away from the volcano, based, again, controlled somewhat by the winds, because the force of that explosion moves material further and it doesn't have a chance to fall as thickly right near the volcano in question. Does that sound familiar to you?
I haven't actually worked on ultraplinian eruptions before, so I'm not totally sure.
The one that I'm most familiar with, I haven't worked on it, but I know I've looked at it and read some papers about it, is the Taupo eruption. It was an ultraplinian eruption that has an off-center thickest area of the deposit, if I remember correctly. The, what is it, 181 AD for the eruption of Taupo?
Around about there. The dates, I'm not sure of the most recent one. It's changed a couple of times.
But there, I'm pretty sure that they, based on looking at the thickness of the deposits and the distribution of those deposits, it's thought to have been about a 50-kilometer plume that would put it into sort of the ultraplinian category of explosive eruptions.
It's interesting. Growing up in New Zealand, the Taupo eruptions were of huge fascination to me. I ended up studying that Ahoi volcano, which produced smaller eruptions a few decades ago. But, you know, you drive for hours across these deposits. The very large eruptions at Taupo, some of them produce caldera collapse. There are very, very large, what we call ignimbrite deposits. And what an ignimbrite is a very, very big pyroclastic flow, a lot of pumice. Some of them are so big and so thick that they've welded and back into a pretty much a solid rock again. And then we have very, very widespread volcanic ash deposits. Like these volcanic ash deposits went hundreds of kilometers away. I've seen some of the models done for even smaller eruptions than that one, how it would affect people today. And they made my skin crawl seeing where all my family live and they would be under these eruptions. But again, reminder that these very large eruptions are also very rare, which is fantastic living on an island country with several large caldera volcanoes. Basically, we look at these huge eruption deposits that spread very far away from the volcano, usually ash fall as well as pyroclastic flow or ignimbrite deposits. Some of those, I don't know if it's always, but especially if there's water interaction, which we've had at Taupō, very fine-grained ash is something to look out for, as well as ash, which we call accretion. Accretion. Can you finish that for me?
Accretionary lapilli is where you're going for.
Thank you. My goodness. Yes, where you have water interaction as well. So you have kind of hailstones of volcanic ash where you have layers building up these tiny little balls in those deposits as well. So in New Zealand, with our very large eruption deposits, that's what I grew up seeing.
So there's two things I wanted to throw in there when you're talking about that. One is accretionary lapilli are fascinating because they are these little sort of like records of the fact that there was maybe precipitation going on at the same time as the eruptions. I have some accretionary lapilli that I use in my classes that I collected from an island off the coast of Maine here in the US that is accretionary lapilli that's probably about 350 million years old.
Wow.
So that's a really cool sort of ash-rich deposit that might record one of these big eruptions that happened many, many millions of years ago, hundreds of millions of years ago in what is now the coast of Maine. So that's kind of fun. I also remember when I was in New Zealand that, you know, I would think of the Taupo eruption. That was 50 cubic kilometers of volcanic ash and debris. And that seemed really huge to me. And then I was introduced to the Aruanui eruption, which was not as recent. It was about 26,000 years ago, but that was somewhere in the vicinity of 500 cubic kilometers. And that's even 500 cubic kilometers of what they call dense rock equivalent, which is taking all of the debris and squeezing all the air out of it. So it's more like maybe 1,000 cubic kilometers of tephra. And that the Aruanui eruption, I remember looking at some of the deposits of that. It's just staggering to think of. I always have the impression that that would make some of these, what we consider ultra-Plinian eruptions, even look small.
Oh, yeah. I was actually recently talking to Michael Greshko at National Geographic about this. I was talking to him about the Ilopango eruption around 539 CE, which was a 43 cubic kilometer, and that's the dense rock equivalent size eruption. So I started looking into other eruptions, and Pinatubo, do you remember how many cubic kilometers Pinatubo was with that huge eruption, the second largest of the 20th century?
The first number that popped into my head was 30 cubic kilometers.
Five.
Only order off by a sixfold.
That's
on
okay.
That one.
I totally threw that at you. That's fine. So Pinatubo was 5 cubic kilometers. Nova Rupta up in Alaska, which was the largest of the 20th century, was 13 cubic kilometers.
Okay, I feel better about that because the first number that popped into my head there is 15 cubic kilometers.
That's
so I was at least closer on that one.
And then we get to Toba. Do you know off the top of your head how many cubic kilometers Toba is?
Toba. See, now I've totally lost all my confidence in my guessing of the volumes here. I'm going to say that it's in the low hundreds. That's my guess.
2,800 cubic kilometers.
I was off there by an order of magnitude. So,
you see,
I got gun shy after overestimating Pinatubo there. So
that's fine. This is a really good point of, you know, not one single volcanologist has all the knowledge. When I do, for every single interview and podcast I do, I prepare because I do not have all of this knowledge sitting in my head. I just know where to find it really quickly.
I have many, many tabs open right now.
So, yeah, the majority of eruptions that we see are less than a cubic kilometer. Far less. Way, way, way less than a cubic kilometer of magma. And those really big ones where you're getting into even over just 40 cubic kilometers are quite rare. And the bigger you go, the rarer. I mean, it's really hard to erupt a lot of magma that's usually really sticky as well when you're getting up to those really violently explosive, very large eruptions. So it's, you know, that's what our planet does. We live with it. People live with active volcanoes all over the place. And it's unlikely that we'll see one of those large eruptions in our lifetime. Yay.
One of the questions we got is what fraction of the world's volcanoes are unmonitored by scientific instruments? And I mean, that's a really hard number to get down precisely, But my hunch is that it's going to be a vast majority of them likely don't have specific monitoring on them, depending on how you want to bin it. You know, is it all volcanoes that have erupted in the last, let's say, 10,000 years or versus...
Which is around 1,400.
1,400, yeah. So, or is it volcanoes that have erupted historically, which might be, you know... Yes. So, you know, I would guess that we're looking at less than half of the, at least what we call the Holocene volcanoes, the last 10,000 years, that less than half. There are many fewer volcanoes that are monitored with instruments than there are volcanoes that likely don't have any instruments on them. That's not to say that they can't be monitored by, let's say, a network of seismometers in across an area, but specific monitoring, I think, is much sparser than the number of volcanoes that are out there.
Yeah, I have no idea what that might be, what the number might be. I don't even know how many volcanoes we have monitored in the world, but no, it's not enough. And, you know, volcanologists and volcano observatories can only do as much as they have funding for. You know, they want to do more. They always want to do more. That's what they do, is they monitor volcanoes, part of what they do, monitor volcanoes to keep people informed and safe and warned when something is going to happen. So, you know, if they don't have funding, they're not getting money, they're going to do the best with what they have. And that's an incredible amount that they do with what they have. But, you know, you might have some volcanoes which could be of concern. We don't know which volcanoes are going to next be erupting, but they might have one seismometer or they might not have one on the volcano itself. So yeah, there's an amazing amount of work going on around the world, but there needs to be so much more support for volcano monitoring before we can improve that.
Yeah, a lot of the times for some of these remote volcanoes, let's say in the Aleutians, we do have to fall back on, you know, remote monitoring. So this is where I feel like I need to backtrack what I said, is that in terms of instrumentation on the ground, the number is probably relatively low percentage-wise. However, with remote sensing, satellite coverage, we probably have some amount of monitoring on a vast majority of the volcanoes on the Earth. It's just that we have to see it happening, get captured by one of the satellites, things like the Terra or Aqua satellites or Sentinels. In that sense, we probably monitor a large majority. It's just sometimes you have to have somebody who is looking at the right place at the right time to notice that an eruption was happening and the conditions were right to get it captured by the satellite.
Yeah, absolutely. And sometimes that's a tourist is going by on a cruise in a remote place and they start tweeting or posting on Facebook about an eruption. And then we look at their satellites and go, oh, wow, look at that. But you have a good point. There are remote ways that we can look at these. There are more nationwide seismic networks that pick up earthquake. There is infrasound, which is basically picking up volcano burps. I don't know if geophysicists will be mad at me saying that, but you know, it's pressure waves through the atmosphere instead of waves through the ground. There's volcanic lightning, which is really, really cool. You can pick that up on international and national networks as well. So there are ways of monitoring volcanoes from far away. And the Alaska Volcano Observatory is very good at that with the Aleutian volcanoes they have.
I'd say that we're probably keeping an eye on a lot more places than we have been able to in the past. And that's part of why sometimes it feels like there might be more volcanic activity than there has been in the past. And that's because at least we can keep an eye on some things. Okay, so the thing with the remote sensing is that we can see when volcanoes are erupting. That's different than being able to measure that a volcano is on the way to an eruption through things like
earthquakes.
That's where it kind of gets tricky, is that you can monitor volcanoes that are erupting or monitor volcanoes, well, maybe not or, but you can monitor the precursors to an eruption. And that's, of course, going to be a lot more helpful for hazards than just being able to say, hey, look, that volcano's already erupting. It'd be good to be able to see the signs of it. And that's where ground-based stuff is the most useful.
Yeah, trust me, if you're living next to a city or a town that's on, near, or downwind of a volcano, you want your volcano observatory to be monitoring that before anything is happening. And that's what they want to do. That is what they do. So yeah, it's better to have something monitored for years before an eruption, because then you know what the normal background activity is. Because volcanoes that are not active in our lifetimes, they can still have activity, like seismic swarms, for example, which is a higher amount of earthquakes over a few days or weeks. That's pretty normal for a lot of volcanoes without any eruption ever happening. If you started monitoring a volcano today and you saw a seismic swarm, you might be very concerned that something was about to happen. So how do you know if that is normal for that volcano and nothing is going to happen, or if it's actually going to lead to an eruption? If you're the community near that volcano, you're going to want to know the difference.
So another question that we got was, is there a sequence of eruption types that volcanoes follow during their lifetime? For example, starting with effusive eruptions and later moving on to more explosive ones. And this one's kind of tricky, this question, because I think the answer is yes and no. I think for a lot of volcanoes, it isn't. There is no, across all volcanoes, there is no set pattern. That's one thing. For certain types of volcanoes, there are sequences. So we talk about Hawaiian style eruptions, and they tend to have a sequence where they start off with potentially more explosive eruptions for that style of volcano, a shield volcano that erupts basalt that's runnier, is that it can be more explosive in the form of fire fountains early on in an eruption and then become more lava flows as the eruption goes on. But that's not really the lifetime of the volcano. It's each successive sequence of eruptions that happen on the volcano.
Yeah, I actually looked into this question a few months ago. Someone was claiming that volcanoes that haven't erupted in a long time are more likely to produce large explosive eruptions. So I started asking around people that have actually looked at these numbers, and the answer is we don't see any evidence that that is true at all. As we've mentioned, one particular volcano can produce a range of eruption styles. Even saying that this volcano is going to produce this type of eruption is difficult. The more data we get leading up to an eruption, the more the observatories can say, okay, we're most likely going to see this sort of activity. But before that happens, no, we don't have that. Some volcanoes can produce very large eruptions immediately, like Calbuco in 2015. There was no warning before that volcano. There were no smaller ash plumes. There were no, any smaller volcanic activity before that happened. And then you have Agung volcano in 63 and 64 that produced lava flows for a few months. And then it produced a large eruption that killed over 1,100 people.
I mean, a lot of this comes down to the magma that's coming into the system. And that is something that a lot of people are working on, is exactly where magma's, what happens after they're formed in the mantle and how they interact with all the crust that they travel through. Some volcanoes, like the volcano I did my PhD on in Chile, Aconquilcha, was like monotonous, I guess is a word to use for it, is that over the course of its lifespan, which is close to 1 million years of activity, it pretty much was erupting almost the same magma in the same form with these big dacitic lava flows every time. And there's other volcanoes where the composition of what erupts can change fairly dramatically from eruption to eruption, depending on how that magma is interacting with things, things like the pre-existing magma under the volcano, with maybe water, with the crust. There's just lots of different ways that it can vary. Even the source magma can change over time. There is no set pattern that all volcanoes are going to follow.
No, it would be great if there was. That would be fantastic. And that is a really good question. But no, these volcanic systems are very dynamic. They're changing. As the magma is moving, it's changing. You have it releasing gas. You might have more gas-rich magma coming up from below, adding gas to the system. You can have crystals forming or even unforming, recycling within that system as well. You can have the composition change over time. The rock it's moving through can change. There are so many things that are changing during the lifetime of magma, from at first forming to erupting, if it ever erupts. There's plenty of magma that never ever erupts. So that we don't, what their magma is doing today doesn't tell us what it's going to be doing in a week or two or a month or a year. It could change before then.
Yeah, kind of another question that we got was, how do we know anything about future volcanoes and what they'll be like? And a lot of that just is making some assumptions that volcanoes will continue to form based on the tectonic settings that they find themselves. So you know, a hot Hawaii is a hot spot where you have a plume of hot mantle material coming up and it forms a certain type of volcano, or a subduction zone where you have oceanic plate going down underneath, let's say, a continental plate, and you get certain kinds of volcanoes. So there isn't anything linked with certain types of volcanoes forming more or less frequently at different points in Earth's history. But we can look at tectonics as the guide of what we might expect to see for sort of future volcanoes, not even future eruptions at existing volcanoes, but a future volcano and what they might end up looking like.
Yeah, there are some things in the past that have happened that we might not get now, like flood basalts. That was a specific, I don't understand them, but it sounds like it was something particular about the Earth at the time that resulted in those forming.
They have, you know, I've read some things that said that flood basalts have been becoming less frequent over Earth's history, related to maybe this sort of cooling of the planet. But whether or not we are in the clear,
yeah, that's what
is, I think, again, up for debate.
We should get a flood basalts person on here.
Yes.
But so we have eruptions that have happened in the past that are very unlikely, if not probably won't happen again. And, you know, you mentioned the subduction zones, where we have, you know, something that's, so with the work I'm currently doing, the whole volcano types thing really bugs me, because people look at these, we're taught in school these different volcano types. So we have shield volcano, stratovolcano, caldera. And the issues that I see as a communicator is that people look at a volcano and say, well, that volcano is this shape, therefore this is what it's going to do. But that's so not the case. I mean, shield volcanoes is probably the closest, because they usually produce lava flows that are running and move further away. But then we look at Kilauea last year, that after 30 odd years produced decent ash plume. And then we look at Oregon and Washington. We have calderas, we have these stratovolcanoes, we have scoria cones, and we have volcanic fields that have multiple scoria cones. We have shield volcanoes in Oregon. Volcanoes or volcano? How many shield volcanoes are in Oregon?
I mean, shield volcanoes? Oh, I mean, it's dozens and dozens. I don't know the exact number, but there are a lot, because some of them are fairly small, but there's a lot.
Yeah. So it's, you know, each of these volcanoes is a different type, I say with my fingers up in the air, and those volcanoes produce different styles of eruptions. So even if you have a particular volcano, if we want to put it into a box, form in an area, that doesn't tell us what that volcano is going to continue to do in the future. It can produce a range of eruptions. So oh, goodness, I'm blanking again. What's the shield volcano in Oregon that's more recent?
There's Newberry.
That's the one I'm thinking of.
Okay, because Newberry's tricky too, because it is a shield volcano, but it's also got those big obsidian lava flows that are associated with it. It's got a lot of basalt, but it's also got a bunch of rhyolite.
Yeah, that's exactly the point I was going to get to. So thank you.
There you go. Newberry is a shield volcano, but it is it is a complicated character.
It is. So yeah, it's, you know, it's a great question. Is there a sequence of eruption types? But usually, most often, the answer is no. Again, there's a question here that I have absolutely no answer to. And you're the petrology guy. Why is there no extrusive equivalent of anorthosite?
Oh, yeah. I thought about this one a little bit. So for those of you who are not familiar with this, anorthosites are igneous rocks. So they describe a rock rather than a magma, but they're mostly made of the mineral plagioclase feldspar. Now, plagioclase feldspar is probably the most common mineral on Earth and throughout the solar system and in rocky planets. It's one of the first things that form when you start crystallizing basalt. And it's got a little bit of other stuff, things like pyroxene, which is another common mineral that you'd find in a basalt, and magnetite, and maybe olivine. These are all minerals that you find it in a basalt. They're weird because you can see anorthosites almost every day. Go outside, look at the moon, look at the lighter colored parts of the moon, and those are the anorthosite highlands of the moon. They are, a lot of them are places where early in the moon's history, it was a magma ocean, and you had these areas where lighter minerals like plagioclase would float on magma and create a crust. So it depends on if you count a magma ocean as an eruption, which I think is something that I have never seen anyone make any arguments for or against. That if the whole surface of a planet or some large portion of the planet is magma, is that an eruption?
That is an interesting question. I would say no, because I mean, here at the Global Volcanism Program, I'm working on eruptions all the time. And, you know, we talk about eruptions as stuff, magmatic stuff is coming out of the ground. So if it's not really coming out of anything, be like more like a giant lava planet. I don't know. I'm gonna go with no, but I have no real scientific basis behind that.
I mean, a magma ocean is more or less just in some degrees like a giant lava lake.
Is it magma or lava at that point? It's at the surface.
I've never heard it. I tend to always hear it as a magma ocean. They don't talk about lava ocean, but at some point, a large portion of the surface of the moon is molten. And the anorthosites form from plagioclase crystallizing and floating on the surface. And then the dark portions of the moon are places where later on magma erupted at the surface, like let's say in a big impact crater, and filled them with dark basalt. So that's where we get the what they call the mare, the seas of the moon. So
the man on the moon.
Yeah, right? Man on the moon or E.T. with a dog. I challenge people to look for that one, but that's a fun one.
I haven't heard
yeah,
that
so anyway. Anorthosites, there isn't a volcanic equivalent because they aren't really a magma. There are no magmas that exist that have a composition of an anorthosite. They're a product of something like basalt crystallizing. So I think that's where sometimes the terminology we use for rocks versus magma gets really complicated. You know, I always try to tell my students that when we talk about magma, we should talk about use the name related to the volcanic equivalent. So you'd say a rhyolite magma rather than a granitic magma. It just, in my mind, keeps things separated in the right way because granite is a rock. It's not a magma. It is defined by large crystals. We inherit the terminology that we use in a discipline, and sometimes it is a hot mess. This is one of these situations.
It is. Yeah, it's amazing, actually. With doing the communication work I've done over the last... Well, especially the last 2 years, you know, I'm driven to help people understand this stuff and to help people when they need information during an eruption. And I get so many incredibly good questions. And so many of these questions are driven by what people are taught on the internet and in school. And so much of it is misunderstanding because of the language we use. So, you know, the language really helps, but it can really make things messy and confusing and just a mess. So I'm sorry, guys. Volcano language is difficult. And every good question in volcanology has a good answer starting with "it depends." And sort of maybe no, yes, sometimes, I'm not sure. I mean, these things are complicated. And I mean, even defining... And magma type can be complicated as well. So it's all complicated. And that's why we have so many different subfields within volcanology. Like Eric is in petrology. I don't know a lot of petrology. I know a lot about volcanic eruptions. I'm a physical volcanologist. I study volcanic eruptions, especially explosive ones and pyroclastic flows. But understanding the crystals that make up those magmas and erupt during those, you know, that's a whole nother subfield that I have a huge respect for. So thank you for your work, Eric. I appreciate it.
Yeah, well, that's the idea here, too, is that I'm definitely not a physical volcanologist. I understand what happens, but, you know, don't look at me to start modeling any of them in the near future. So there you go. We can end with a question that I think is much more clear cut than any of this, because I think it's a question that does not actually require a "it depends." And the question we got sent was, can we mix spent nuclear fuel with lava at a volcano such that it solidifies and subsequent flows bury the waste deeper and deeper? And I can think I can categorically say that would be a bad idea.
No. No, no,
pretty much
that's a straight no.
Pretty much anything that involves nuclear anything and volcanoes is not something you want to go towards. And, you know, even if one could argue that you could do that, because in a sense, we do that when you have spent nuclear fuel, you're going to be mixing it with other material to make it into some sort of solid waste that they put in a drum. And then the drums go, I don't know, they shove them into the trees in the park. No, they actually bury them and hide them away or keep them secluded. Even if you were to put the spent fuel in lava, the rates of eruption would mean that could take, you know, 10,000 years to bury it underneath a few feet of lava. So it would just, it would be a bad idea in all.
Have you ever been to a black sand beach, Eric?
Have I been to a black sand beach? Yes, I have.
Yeah, I have too, because most of the west coast of the North Island of New Zealand has black sand beaches, and those black sand beaches are eroded volcanic rock.
Ah, yes. Good point.
So that is volcanic rock that has eroded down, broken into smaller pieces of rock and minerals, and then has traveled hundreds of kilometers away from where it started, as well as giving nutrients to the ocean and getting, you know, it's volcanic material isn't just buried. It is redistributed around the planet. So no, is my answer.
What we would call the rock cycle leaves us with conclusively to the answer that no, this is a bad idea.
And no, we can't nuke volcanoes to either start or stop volcanic eruptions either. That is another one I get asked all the time. No.
Yes.
No. So much no.
I think I said this on Twitter based on our a current comment by our U.S. president about nuking a hurricane. No problem on Earth with natural disasters can be solved by nuking it. So get that out of your head.
Bad idea.
So there you go. That solution only leads to a radioactive natural disaster, which is always worse than a not radioactive one.
Yeah, let's have incredibly strong winds throwing radioactive material across hundreds of miles. That's not a good idea.
All right. Well, I think with that, we'll wrap up for this month. We'll be back next month with some sort of special guest. You will not have to listen to just the two of us talking the whole time, but hopefully you enjoyed getting some questions answered. Feel free to always send us questions. It's always fun to hear what people are curious about with these with volcanoes.
Yeah, thank you so much for listening. You know, all of these questions are really fascinating, and not one of them, or some of them, not many of them have a straightforward answer. Yeah, keep asking, keep being curious. That's what science is it's curiosity and trying to find answers. So thank you for being part of this. I really appreciate it.
You've enjoyed this month's episode of Popular Volcanics. Thanks to all of our listeners who've supported us on Patreon. And if you'd like to support the podcast, visit patreon.com/popularvolcanics, and you can support us at any level you desire. You can also follow the podcast on Twitter at popvolcanics, or check out the website popularvolcanics.weebly.com. And if you have any questions, feel free to send us an email at popularvolcanics@gmail.com. Also remember, when you're looking for volcanic information about an eruption that's going on, be sure to check with all of the appropriate local authorities rather than taking merely our advice on what's safe to do. And with that, we'll see you next month.